This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
CBS Eye on the World, I'm John Batchelor. Conversation with Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs, publishing most recently Strategic Policy, the Journal of International Strategic Studies Association. I call upon Gregory to take us to Europe. We've been in Asia for some conversation. Olaf Scholz takes us there, his embassy to Beijing, the conversation with business leaders in China, very controversial in Berlin. However, the European situation is mixed because of the limitations of energy and also the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. So I want to introduce to all these variables that the election in the United States is now concluded with what appears to be status quo, at least in terms of domestic policy. Foreign policy, however, is what Gregory helps me with best. And the foreign policy, you write, Gregory, is very unlikely to change. So what is the foreign policy that's not going to change, particularly when it comes to Ukraine? Thank you.
Well, it's basically headline foreign policy, John. There's a bilateral commitment, if you like, in Washington to support Ukraine in its war with Russia. In fact, Ukraine is just a proxy in the Western war with Russia, and the question becomes, is that worthwhile for the West? It's already driven Moscow into the arms of Beijing. What good can come of it for the West? And the answer to that is very little. But the Washington establishment loves to have an enemy by which to define itself. We've now moved, if you like, in many respects, past the age when the United States defined itself by its virtues and values and is now, during the Cold War and subsequently, defined itself by its adversaries. And that was why, if you like, George W. Bush, Bush 43, declared the war on terror as a war, if you like, against al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, which elevated bin Laden to the status of a superpower. And it was never really a worthy adversary, but by elevating the stature of a strategic existential adversary, the U.S. was able to enter this noble fight. Unfortunately, all it did was to create a much greater terrorist and radical Islamist opposition and give it coherence and prestige of its own. So now that the midterm elections are passed, I think we will see that President Biden no longer sees the same sort of utility in continuing a war against Russia, even though he I believe, personally feels very strongly about his opposition to Russia. But I think we'll start to see a winding back of practical commitment to the support of Ukraine or the proxy war against Russia, and we'll start to see exploration of negotiating tactics with Russia. Now, the Russians themselves offered a number of olive branches at various stages in the past few months, including President Putin's very, very personal and heartfelt condolences on to the British public and to the Royal Family of Britain on the death of Queen Elizabeth. And the British government brushed that aside because at that stage, Prime Minister Liz Truss felt that she had to commit to this strenuously anti-Russian line, which she inherited from Boris Johnson, the former prime minister, and because of the alliance with the United States. But this was a genuine attempt to start a dialogue from Russia's point of view. Russia again tried that a couple of weeks ago, and I think now that the midterms are over, we'll start to see the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, start opening those doors with both Moscow and Tehran in an attempt to do what Nixon did in 1972, which was to break up that great monolithic Eurasian opposition bloc.
The war in Ukraine right in front of us right now is fog of war. But you write most recently in Strategic Policy that Turkey is a player to watch because it has participated, I'd say, fence sitting between Moscow and Brussels, between NATO and Russia. It is a member of NATO. I understand that. But the conversation between Mr. Erdogan and President Putin is mysterious to me. Has Turkey put itself in a position to gain from the resolution of Ukraine? You write that it's looking for a way to offset its domestic disappointments.
Well, certainly, President Erdogan is under severe pressure because he's collapsed the economy of Turkey. He's got inflation going up from 80% to 90% a year. The value of the Turkish lira has halved in the past. Well, it's actually more than halved. It halved in 2021 over 2020, and it went down by another 35-40% this year already. So the economic plight of the average Turkish citizen is dire at this stage, and the ability of Turkey to sustain its global power projection, which is part of President Erdogan's big ego, that's becoming questionable. And Turkey is literally has been in the hands of Russia, which can cut off the oil and gas supplies going across from Central Asia through the pipelines, particularly from the Baku pipeline starting in Azerbaijan across to Turkey and then down to the Mediterranean. If that's cut off, Turkey loses massive amounts of foreign exchange. So basically, Turkey has to kowtow to Moscow. And the Turks and the Russians don't trust each other and generally hate each other, but Turkey has no option but to kowtow to Moscow. Yes, Erdogan is straddling the line, one foot in the Western camp, one foot in the Eastern camp. However, in the last couple of months, he's put more of the weight on the foot in the Eastern or Eurasian camp. He was at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Samarkand in mid-September. He is basically committed to a strategic policy which sees Turkey as the leader of the Turkic peoples, who largely are the Central Asian peoples, and he sees himself as having a role in the Middle East and Africa. This may all come tumbling down, or Erdogan may start a war again with Greece in the near future, simply so that he can declare a state of emergency and postpone or cancel the elections for June next year, which would normally see him thrown out of office because of what he's done to the Turkish people in an economic sense. So basically, we're going to see Turkey being the dynamic element of this. Turkey has been supportive of Ukraine during this war, provided them with a whole lot of unmanned combat aerial vehicles, but it's also doing the bidding of Moscow. So it's trying to be the power broker in all of this. Nobody wants to let it go, neither Russia nor the West. But the reality is that the whole Western alliance, if you like, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, is right now in a position where it is being seen to be incredibly ineffective and meaningless. It's not the military alliance which we saw in the late 1980s, which was superbly efficient. It's now just a loose political alliance which cannot galvanize all of its members into unified military efficiency or capability. And Germany is one of the worst offenders in this. Its military capability has declined precipitously, and Olaf Scholz is now flailing around in the hope, and his only hope is that Germany still retains control of the euro and therefore has some leverage in Europe.
Does Erdogan have a power base to project power into the Black Sea Basin? You mentioned his domestic policy. It's been rocky for years. But following the conflict in Ukraine, does Turkey emerge as a power broker?
It's attempting to emerge as a power broker. And the problem is that Erdogan himself had weakened the armed forces of Turkey so much that Turkey's credibility as a strategic power has diminished enormously. Erdogan's sole power base within the country, and his tool to project power is not the armed forces, but the military intelligence, or sorry, the strategic intelligence organization known as MIT, National Intelligence Organization. And that's the organization which has done a lot of power struggle activities, suppressing opponents at home, conducting the illegal sale of stolen oil out of Syria, for example. It's basically a criminal organization which has propped up Erdogan in the past. And the question is how much longer that's going to be viable as well.
Gregory, I want to move from the Black Sea Basin to Africa, because you are helping me understand two important states, Ethiopia on the east and Nigeria on the west. I begin with Ethiopia because it appears that Prime Minister Abiy has once again stabilized the civil war, the war front. In the United States, however, there have been open questions about supporting Prime Minister Abiy. After this midterm election, do you expect to be any significant change by the State Department, which heretofore has been oddly endorsing the rebel group TPLF?
Yes, I don't think the midterms are going to impact the State Department's approach to its support for the Tigray Popular Liberation Front, which is an extremist Marxist military organization claiming to represent the people of the Tigray region of Ethiopia, which they don't in fact do. The reality is that Prime Minister Abiy's active galvanizing of his armed forces to fight the TPLF has basically forced the TPLF into negotiation. And the African Union offered its services as an arbitrator in ending this particular war. And the former president of Nigeria, Olusegun Obasanjo, himself a former general, was very successful in pulling the sides into negotiation. About a week ago in Pretoria, South Africa, we saw this coming to a head. We knew something was really happening of a serious nature, because most of the senior generals in the TPLF managed to slip out of Tigray province and make their way down to South Africa. So we knew that they were going to be involved in some kind of military settlement of this conflict. A ceasefire and peace treaty of sorts was negotiated and announced a week or so ago in Pretoria. That was followed up by further detailed discussions in Nairobi, Kenya, again under the auspices of the African Union, as to how they would implement that. In the meantime, what we saw was that because the United States was no longer able to keep supplying the TPLF, the TPLF was forced into a negotiating submission. My belief is that as soon as the TPLF regains some strength, they'll attempt to start a secessionist war again. I don't believe that they will in any way honor that treaty. And in fact, they haven't honored anything they've agreed to in the past. So this is a short-term respite. And yes, there is a plan in place to disarm the TPLF troops still in Tigray region. That's going to be very tricky, because they're going to be reluctant to give up their arms. Most of those arms were given to them by the United States when the TPLF was controlling the Ethiopian government until 2018. The TPLF, in exchange for giving the Obama administration access to airfields in Aba Minch, for example, in southern Ethiopia, to run drone operations against Somalis, the agreement was that the Obama administration would train the TPLF militia, arm them, and by the way, train them by U.S. Special Forces personnel, arm them extensively and give them lots of money. So the TPLF became, if you like, the client of the United States. And then when the Obama administration left office, and then when the TPLF itself collapsed, their government collapsed in 2018, they went into the hills as a guerrilla force, and then decided they wanted to come back into power in Ethiopia. And that's when the new war started. Okay, so we've got a brief respite there, which is good. But in the meantime, the other major armed rebel group or secessionist group, the Oromo Liberation Front, has now become very, very active. And the the government, which is run, Prime Minister Abbey is the head of the Oromo faction in the ruling party. So he's been forced to go to war with his fellow Oromo population, or parts of it, with the Oromo Liberation Army and the Oromo Liberation Front. And that's reached a point of pitched battles over the past few weeks. And we've seen, literally in the last 2 days, hundreds and hundreds of people killed within those battles. And most of those are civilians. Now, what we saw with the TPLF's war, which the TPLF began and prosecuted outside the area of Tigray, was about 500,000 people killed and over 1 million refugees. Right. And a similar situation is now underway with the Oromo Liberation Front, who are basically fighting mostly against the Amhara people. So it's the next civil war, if you like, underway in Ethiopia right now. The Egyptians have been supporting the Oromo Liberation Front simply because they want to weaken Ethiopia as the country which controls the headwaters of the Blue Nile, which gives Egypt ultimately most of its water.
Gregory Copley, editor and publisher of Defense and Foreign Affairs. We will touch on Nigeria another day because we are inaugurating our report of King Charles III, Monarchy in the 21st Century. Gregory Copley, I'm John Patrick.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.